After hearing the second new question, I was momentarily taken aback. Zeidenberg asked if it was true. The president told me in the Oval Office that Karl Rove told him he was not involved. It was the first time I'd been asked about something the president knew or said. Since the president had not been questioned yet, I knew that Andy must have discussed it with investigators at some earlier point. Knowing the president's preference that his private conversations remain private, I hesitated momentarily, but this was different. I knew forthrightness was the only option. A frog in my throat, I managed to confirm that the president had indeed made such a statement. Zeidenberg wrapped up his questioning and asked jurors if they had any questions. Only a young African-American woman seated at the far end of the room in the first row had a question. She asked me to define what background, deep background, and off the record meant to me. I responded by saying that the terms meant slightly different things to different reporters. My understanding, I said, is that background means a reporter can quote you but not reference you by name. The reporter and the source will usually agree as to what the attribution should be, a senior White House official, a senior administration official, or if the source wants to have more distance, maybe a Republican official or a U.S. government official. As for deep background, most reporters view it as information they can use in their reporting but can't attribute in any way or directly quote the source. And off the record means to me that the reporter can't use the information in any way in his reporting. The session was over within an hour. Roos and one of the agents thanked me as they walked me back out to the hallway. They also said that while I was legally free to talk about it, they would prefer that I keep my grand jury testimony private. As I headed toward the stairs, a journalist standing in the hallway recognized me and followed me down the stairs. She introduced herself as a CBS producer and asked where my attorney was. I looked behind me and playfully said, "I don't know, you didn't see him back there?" After she looked around for a few seconds, I said I didn't have one. She expressed surprise since everyone else she had seen come in did. A few other reporters were gathered just outside the courthouse, trying to get some cover from the day's light drizzle. I put on a nonchalant smile as I stopped to answer a few questions. "Just glad to do my part to fully cooperate with the investigation, as the president directed us to do," I said before getting into my car. The investigation continued for months, without causing any real distraction during the successful re-election campaign. Still, White House staff would not speak with one another about it. The counsel's office had long ago put the kibosh on anyone talking publicly about it, including myself. And privately, people had spent enough money on attorneys and enough time responding to investigators that no one wanted to do anything that might cause more of our government paychecks and already stretched schedules to be eaten up. I imagine some people slipped at times and found themselves complaining about their hours before the grand jury or gossiping about who done it. On a few occasions, even the president couldn't help himself. I remember hearing him in the Oval or on Air Force One grousing about having to hire an attorney and about the atmospherics of being questioned. The president was interviewed by Patrick Fitzgerald and some of his team for about 70 minutes in the Oval in late June 2004. Shooter, as the president nicknamed his private lawyer, Jim Sharp, was also present. Al Gonzalez had testified to the grand jury several days earlier, and the vice president had been interviewed at the beginning of June. I have no knowledge of what any of them told prosecutors. Karl Rove's first appearance before the grand jury was on October 15, 2004. Coming just weeks before Election Day, it was used by Democrats as an opportunity to take shots at the president. The Kerry campaign, seeking any political mileage they could get at that late stage in the game, called for Rove and the White House to come clean about their role in this insidious act. It would be Rove's only grand jury appearance before the election, but it would not be his last. From the outset of the investigation, the president had made a decision not to pursue the matter internally. He said he wanted to get to the bottom of questionable activity surrounding the leak episode, but he did not order any White House staff members to mount an investigation, nor to take any other proactive steps to uncover the truth or inform the public. At least in part, on the advice of White House lawyers and other key advisors, he chose to leave the leak and its consequences solely to the special counsel. The approach stood in stark contrast to the way the White House had approached the 16 words controversy that led to the scandal. In that case, once the decision had been made to determine how the words had made it into the presidential address, we got to the bottom of what happened fairly quickly and shared information as completely as possible. By approaching the controversy openly and forthrightly, we shortened its shelf life in the news and diminished any momentum for the outside investigation on the specific controversy at the time that congressional Democrats initially advocated it. But when it came to the disclosure of Plame's identity, we left it to outside inquiries by reporters and prosecutors, allowing the matter to harden into a permanent state of suspicion and warfare, as Bob Woodward, in Shadow, described the legacy of Watergate and its effect on Nixon's successors. The risk of taking this approach should have been clear, but in the bubble of the White House, sometimes you learn the wrong lessons of history and fail to recognize this reality. You become so focused on protecting the president, you don't realize you're rolling the dice and losing control of the problem. I didn't know anything about the leak or its causes. Uninformed about efforts to discredit Wilson, I simply assumed the best about them and key advisors to the president. I believed, based in no small part on the categorical assurances I'd received from Libby and Rove, that the White House had not been involved in leaking classified information or creating an environment that led to its disclosure. Sadly, I eventually learned otherwise. Would I have pushed for addressing the matter openly and directly if I'd been more knowledgeable about the facts and circumstances, if I'd been on the job longer, or if I'd had previous experience with criminal investigations? I like to think so. I've always believed the term "no comment" is a terrible communication strategy. It inevitably comes across as suspicious and defensive. But in this case, I went along with the decision that was in place. Now I wish I hadn't. During the 2000 campaign, candidate George W. Bush had pledged to be different, but at the White House, he chose to be the same. Just as the Clinton presidency had done when it came to questionable activity, we perpetuated the endless investigations and scandals we'd vowed to move beyond by engaging in spin, stonewalling, hedging, evasion, denial, non-communication, and deceit by omission. The decision to invade Iraq, more than anything else, took the Bush presidency off course, and our excessive embrace of the political tactics at the heart of Washington's culture of deception kept it there. When candor could have helped minimize the political fallout from the unraveling of the chief rationale for war, spin and evasion were instead what we employed. While those tactics worked to our short-term advantage and did nothing to hurt the president's re-election cause, our primary objective at the beginning, the longer-term effect was to undermine his presidency and to keep Washington from moving beyond the partisan warfare that had engulfed it years before. As for Patrick Fitzgerald, the special counsel, he was determined to do only one thing, his job. That meant not worrying about the partisan back and forth or any artificial timetables for getting to the truth in Washington's otherwise truth-deficient culture. Unknown to anyone outside his determined team of professionals, obstruction of justice charges were already being considered against at least one and possibly two White House officials. In the grand scheme of things, the leak episode didn't help our efforts to address the challenges and problems in Iraq or the volatile Middle East or our own security interests there. It just served to perpetuate Washington's destructive culture of deception, rooted in the partisan warfare embraced by our elected leaders in Washington. All of this at a time when America's men and women in uniform were fighting abroad, hoping only to return home one day and reunite with loved ones. But those of us at the White House during that time can only fault ourselves for all the attention the leak received. The lack of openness, forthrightness, and straightforward honesty to this day still fuels critics and raises questions about the president's truthfulness and honesty, traits at one time perceived to be among his greatest personal attributes. And through it all, ironically, the White House successfully kept the potentially most embarrassing and damaging issue for the president from being closely scrutinized, the larger issue at the heart of the original 16-word controversy. How policymakers used the intelligence on Iraq to make the case that Iraq was a grave and gathering threat, sufficient to justify a preemptive war. Questions surrounding that larger issue are paramount to understanding the decision to invade Iraq and its lessons for history. Exploring those questions and the decision by the president and his key advisors to avoid the potential consequences of openness and forthrightness about them is also at the heart of understanding what took his presidency off course and prevented it from getting back on track. Instead of embracing candor and honesty when they were most needed and using them to his advantage, the president decided to avoid them for fear of political damage. His advisors went along with his decision. The result would be a sustained loss of standing with the public and a president left clinging to the belief that history and posterity will overlook the inherent deception in such an approach and burnish his legacy if his vision of success in Iraq can ultimately be achieved. But I wouldn't come to realize any of this for many months. Back in late 2004, the president was on his way to making history another way, by winning a prized second term.